Turning to today's subject, the subject we've set is Britain's struggle with America to dominate the post-war Middle East. Our speaker today is a very knowledgeable person on this subject, James Barr. He's a leading historian of the modern Middle East and author of four books, including the widely acclaimed Line in the Sand, which was the history of the Sykes-Picot Agreement and its consequences. His latest book, which is really the subject of today's lecture, is called Lords of the Desert. It tells the forgotten story of the struggle between America and Britain to dominate the post-war Middle East. James read modern history at Oxford, and then he was a visiting fellow at St. Anthony's College. He's worked in politics in a number of respects. He's written for the Daily Telegraph, he's been in the city, he's worked in the embassy in Paris, and he runs his own research business. He's currently a political advisor to Tom Tugendhat, MP, who's the chairman of the House of Commons Select Committee on Foreign Affairs. He's also a visiting fellow at King's College London. His book, The Lords of the Desert, is available for sale today, but if anyone would like to buy it, I'm sure that James would be prepared to sign it for you. I'm looking very much forward to hearing what he has to say. I should just add one thing that I'm very grateful to him for too, and that is that he was the person who recommended Jacqueline Jinks to me. We all owe a debt of gratitude for that. So James, without more ado, I'll ask you to speak.
Michael, thank you very much for that very warm introduction. Thank you, Jacqueline, as well, for inviting me. Thanks to the Mossad coup in 1953, we tend to think of Britain and America as being sort of hand in glove in the Middle East. That's the takeaway from that great and infamous event. And of course, it's been reinforced by things that have happened since then. So if you think of the 1991 Gulf War, and then of course what happened after 2003, again that gives us a sense that Britain and America are always arm in arm in that part of the world. But if you go back before recent history, back into the 1940s and the 1950s in particular, you find a very, very different story. And that's what I wrote about in Lords of the Desert, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. And it's one in which you find that Britain and America are invariably competing, perhaps even in the 1953 coup, and often outright rivals with each other. And so that, in a sense, is the thread that runs through the story that I'm going to talk about. You get a glimpse of this in a really odd and interesting anecdote that I start the book with, which happened at some point at the end of the 1940s when the Conservatives were out of government. And Anthony Eden was writing probably quite a wide-ranging speech, but he needed some advice on the question of housing, which, of course, was a huge issue after the war. And the man he turned to was Enoch Powell, who was then the Conservative sort of go-to big brain in the days before he became better known for other things. And in his retirement, Eden recounts the conversation that he had with Powell, and they talked a bit about housing, and then at the end, Powell fixed him with that sort of chilly stare of his and says, I want to talk to you about something. I want to tell you that in the Middle East, our great enemies are the Americans. Now, Eden recounted this long after he'd retired, and he said, I had no idea what he meant then. I do now. And I'm not convinced by that, or at least I'm not convinced that Eden didn't know, because in fact there's plenty of evidence that what Powell was talking about then was pretty uncontroversial. And you see it in a book written by Richard Crossman, so across the other side of the house. Crossman had served on the Palestine, on the Anglo-American committee trying to resolve the question of Palestine after the war, and he said, he wrote in his book, the greatest danger to British rule in the Middle East today is the Americans. And then in 1949, again, and then across the Atlantic, a book was published called Arabs, Oil and History by a then very little known journalist whose name was Kermit Roosevelt. Of course, he wasn't just a journalist. And he wrote in his book that he, having looked at sort of what happened around the region, he said, actually, Americans and British in the Middle East get along rather badly. And so there's a plenty of evidence. And if you go into the archives, as I did with the book, you find more and more to back up this idea. And indeed, Eden himself, in July 1943, wrote an entire memorandum on the subject of the growing complexities in the Anglo-American relationship in the Middle East and how this was a problem. And the reason it was a problem, as far as he was concerned, was because the Americans were now backing the Zionists. And he talked about a revival of Arabism and Zionism. And this was a problem because, in a sense, Britain had tried to harness both these forces before in the First World War and had managed to do so relatively successfully up to that point. But then come 1943, they were no longer in charge. There was a likelihood of a renewed outbreak of violence in Palestine. And crucially, the American Zionists were backing the Zionists, and suddenly Britain had to contend with a whole new thing. So the story starts in 1942 with the Battle of Al Alamein, essentially, and it ends in 1967 with Britain's rather rapid departure from Aden. And it really turns on three issues and an irony. Well, I'll come back to the irony at the end of the talk, but the three issues are an ideology, empire, a commodity, oil, and a personality, Gamal Abdel Nasser. And those three things were the key things that Britain and America could not see eye to eye on in the Middle East. Let's start with empire. In 1942, Britain was the undisputed power in the Middle East. There was no question that, although she faced rivalry with the French that I described in A Line in the Sand, there was no question that Britain was top dog. The British were essentially pulling the strings in Egypt, where the High Commissioner was effectively running the country and worked out of an office on 10 Sharia Tulumbat, which was just known by everybody as Number 10. And there were about 800,000, there's an 800,000 strong ration strength there in 1942 of people who, as far as Churchill was concerned, needed to be ready to fight and die in that country's defence to stop Rommel from breaking through. And then moving further eastwards, obviously the British had got hold of Palestine, or taken the mandate, perhaps rather more polite way of putting it, for Palestine after the First World War, and were again the sort of power behind the throne in Jordan and Iraq, which were nominally independent, but still essentially British colonies, for want of a better word. And the British were also now in Syria and Lebanon following the 1941 invasion with de Gaulle's Free French. So Britain was there. Britain was absolutely running this part of the world. And I even forgot Iran, where, in fact, of course, the British and the Russians had jumped in 1941 as well. So the British were occupying that country too. And the British plan was essentially to hang on to that part of the world for as long as possible. And the way they were going to do this was to create the thing that Lawrence of Arabia had first thought about in the 1910s, a greater Syria, an Arab, sort of a grand Arab state that was going to essentially protect Britain's position on the Suez Canal. So that was Britain's strategy in the mid-40s. And it was a fair assumption that this could happen. Obviously, the question of whether the Arabs could unite was a moot point, but they thought they would get American acquiescence to this, because after all, after the First World War, the Americans had receded. They disappeared off again, and isolationism had returned. And as Churchill said in a cabinet meeting, we don't need US help in this area and aren't likely to see many of them there from now on. That's come from some of the cabinet secretaries' minutes. It's one of the key sources I use in the book, the minute books that are actually the books that the cabinet secretary writes in actually during the meeting, and from which you actually get real sort of snatches of verbatim conversation, not the rather bland minutes that actually come out printed after the meetings. So Britain hoped that they would get American acquiescence, but that was wrong. That was misjudged, and it was misjudged for two reasons, or at least it provoked two contrasting American reactions. One was a very visceral anti-imperialism, but there was also sort of a fairly cold calculation about commercial issues as well. And I'm going to talk about two people who kind of encapsulate these issues. The first of them is Wendell Willkie. Now, he's someone who nowadays most people will barely have heard of. But in 1942, he was very, very famous indeed. And his story is rather resonant because he was a businessman who'd come from nowhere to seize the Republican Party nomination in 1940. But unlike the current incumbent of the White House, he lost the 1940 election against Roosevelt. But he was still a very popular man. He had not become unpopular as a result of the defeat. And Roosevelt in 1942, facing the prospect of midterm elections, decided he'd send Wilkie off on a round-the-world tour to get him out of the way. Wilkie's first stop, the first point where he really touched down, was Cairo. And he made this circumnavigation of the world. The two things that really struck him in the Middle East, I think, were the squalor that he saw, which appalled him, and also the attitude of the British and French officials that he met. And there were two good examples of this. So he had dinner with some British officials in Alexandria as he came back from the front. He went to meet Monty at the front, where Monty was getting ready to fight the Battle of Al Alamein. And he came back, he had dinner with these British officials, and he asked them about the Atlantic Charter. Now, that was the document that Churchill had been coerced into signing by Roosevelt the previous year. And it pledged Britain to recognise self-determination for all peoples and free trade. Now, two concepts that were really going to erode the British Empire. And he found that these officials, who he spoke to, had really no idea what the Charter was and certainly had no particular view that it was going to affect their careers in any way. And the second thing he did was he had a conversation with de Gaulle in Beirut. Rather wonderfully, he describes this. I haven't actually got the best description of this in the book, but I can tell it to you now. He went into a room in Beirut in the High Commission, and it was empty apart from... So there was de Gaulle there, and there was a table and chairs, and it was empty apart from seven statues or paintings of Napoleon on the walls. Anyway, de Gaulle explained that his struggle of the moment was whether Britain or France was going to rule that part of the world. And that sort of kind of confounded Wilkie, who thought that the aim of what was going on was to fight the war, and was then found that essentially what was going on was this struggle between the two imperial powers for who was going to run Syria and Lebanon afterwards. So he came away. He came back to America. He did a radio broadcast. He'd only won 22 million votes in 1940. 36 million people listened to him speak. And this was an indirect, he never mentioned the British Empire, but it was an attack on the British Empire. And then a few days later, just before the midterms, he decided it was the right moment to say something that might encourage Jewish voters to go out and vote for the Republicans. And he, on the 25th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, he called for the opening of the gates of Palestine and essentially unrestricted immigration and for the creation of a Jewish state. So here that was one reaction to this. And it's actually to Wilkie that Churchill is responding. When Churchill then gives his famous... this is not the beginning of the end, but the end of the beginning speech at Mansion House just after Al Alamein. He goes on in the second half of the speech to talk about that he's not become the King's First Minister to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. And that is a rebuttal of Wilkie. It's not an attack on Roosevelt, it's an attack, it's a reply to what Wilkie had said on the radio just a few weeks earlier, a few days earlier. So that was one response. And that got the Americans interested in what was going on in the Middle East to a degree that they'd never been before. The American presence before that was minimal in the Middle East and really confined to missionary activity and a few oil men and a few archaeologists. But the oil was not, at that point, a big concern. But the man who then arrived was a guy who has been, if Wilkie's relatively little known, then James Landis has been completely forgotten. But he's a very interesting character, and there's a fabulous picture of him in the book, which you'll find if you buy it. And he arrived to become the Director of Economic Operations in the Middle East, which sounds like a rather bland title. But he was a regulator. He had worked under FDR in the New Deal in the 1930s. And he regarded the British Empire like one of those big companies that the New Deal had been involved in trying to break up in the 1930s. And he decided he was going to make it his job to unpick the strategy that the British were going to try and use to hang on after the war. And that strategy, very, very briefly, was essentially to try and keep controls over imports going for as long as possible after the war to stop the Americans breaking into that market and to basically create a market for British goods. Now, of course, the Americans on the other side could see that when the war ended, they were going to have an awful lot of spare industrial capacity. And if they didn't want to have another depression, then they needed to find somewhere to export to. So Landis decided that what he would do was break this open, and he managed to do that. So that was the sort of the wartime story. And by the time that Landis was in the process of destroying the British scheme, oil was becoming an issue. And here again, Britain was the dominant force. The Americans were nowhere in the Middle East at that time. Or they weren't nowhere, but they had a very small presence. And in a way, the cards were all against them. Because the British government owned the major oil producer, the major company, Anglo-Iranian, that was drilling in Iran. And that was producing 750,000 barrels a day, which were then being refined at Abadan, on the Shatt al-Arab. And not only that, that was a huge sort of motor of wealth it created. It was just minting Britain money, because for every... every ton of oil cost a shilling to get out the ground. It was being sold for 20 shillings a pound in Europe. So it was a huge cash cow for the British government. It made Britain money in various different ways. Not only did it contribute to 100 million of foreign exchange, but then the company paid taxes and dividends, and the British government was the major shareholder. So the government was getting probably 40-odd million a year or something like that from Anglo-Iranian. And this was something that looked like it was set to continue, because the other thing, through Anglo-Iranian, the British government had a share in IPC, the Iraq Petroleum Company, which was the other major producer at that time. And IPC was crucial because that did actually have some American involvement. But the Red Line Agreement, which dated from 1928, stopped any of the members of that company from doing anything else in the Middle East without all the shareholders' agreements. So Anglo-Iranian effectively had a sort of blocking vote on any American attempt to invest elsewhere in the Middle East. And that was going to affect the fortunes of the company that dominates the middle of the book, which is Aramco. Because Aramco needed to break out of the situation it was in. It was producing two-thirds of what, or maybe less than that, of what Anglo-Iranian was. And crucially, it was just at this massive competitive disadvantage, because it had to ship the oil around the Horn of Arabia, and really its market was far east-facing at that point in time. It couldn't compete. And so the Americans came up with this idea of the tap line. And I just talk about this in the book, and I won't go into it in great detail now. But the crucial thing was that the tap line was what drew the Americans into Levantine politics in a big way, because it crossed Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. And up to that point, the American interest in the politics of those countries was quite limited. But when they needed to start negotiating way leaves to get the pipeline to run through the countries so that Saudi oil could compete with British oil at a fair rate, suddenly they became interested. And that leads to a very, very interesting episode, and it's actually described by Kim Roosevelt in his book, Arabs, Oil and History, in very camouflaged ways. It's a fascinating book because he describes how he personally wrecked the British scheme by playing off the Iraqis and the Jordanians against each other. So if you think of the Greater Syria scheme, that was probably going to federate some or all of those countries that the pipeline passed through. And Roosevelt saw it as his job while he was pretending to be a journalist for Harper's Magazine in 1947 to go in there to get information out of the British ambassador, who said rather more than he should have done, and then to give that information to the Iraqis. And what the British ambassador told him was that, in fact, Britain was indeed surreptitiously backing the ambitions of King Abdullah of Jordan. And so Roosevelt said, thank you very much, I'll take that. And he went to Baghdad and said, oh, did you know that the British are backing this? And that blew apart the Greater Syria Plan very effectively. At the other end of the peninsula, Aramco was also trying to extend the influence of Ibn Saud, then the king, into the sort of into the Rub al Khali, the empty quarter, which was at that point, the frontiers had not been demarcated at all. And that drew in a man called Wilfred Thesiger, who most people have heard of, but not necessarily in this context. Because Thesiger, of course, was a keen explorer. He was keen to explore that part of the world. But having crossed the Empty Quarter a couple of times, he then had a conversation with a man from Iraq Petroleum Company, which had drilling rights in Oman. And he admitted during that conversation that he'd been approached by Aramco to work for them. And at that point, IPC jumped in and grabbed him and hired him. And so if you look at the pattern of Thesiger's travels that he describes in Arabian Sands, you'll see he makes a couple of journeys across the desert. And then he uses the little extensive oasis of Barami as this point to sort of complete a series of petal-like, almost sort of, they look like the petals of a flower, journeys into sort of towards Saudi territory. And his job there was essentially to look for oil, but also to look for evidence of American incursions into that area. So I think it's quite interesting to think that although you think of Thesiger as this sort of exploration, it's from that era of exploration that included, say, the ascent of Everest, Anglo-American rivalry lurks as the sort of one of the motor forces in that particular episode. Oil also lubricates the really the hinge of the story, which is the 50-50 deal in 1950. Now, Aramco had managed to get rather too good an arrangement with the Saudis, which the Saudis by the late 1940s were regretting. And in 1949, Ibn Saud decided he was going to put pressure on the company. He'd already got Aramco to improve its offer, but he hadn't managed to change the whole terms of the deal. The problem was that he got a royalty for every barrel produced, but what he needed was something tied to the company's profit, because whenever output dropped, and in 1949 it did go down because demand went down, of course then the Saudi revenues dropped as well. So he needed something tied to the company's profitability. And the Saudis were very good. They had an extraordinary finance minister called Abdullah Suleiman, who one British diplomat described as the only finance minister I ever met who drank methylated spirit. But Suleiman was definitely a functioning alcoholic, because he had understood the US tax code and understood a very, very important thing, which was that Aramco, as an American domiciled company, would be able to offset any foreign taxes it paid against its American tax bill. So the Saudis came up with the idea of taxing Aramco rather than getting a royalty out of it, and knowing that that wouldn't actually affect the company's ability to invest, because all they would do is set that tax bill against the US tax bill. So ultimately it was going to be the US taxpayer picking up the tab, because they didn't want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. So that's what happened in 1950. And that put that created immense difficulties for the British, because if you remember back, the point was that Anglo-Iranian was just a money-making machine, a cash machine for the British government. The last thing the British government wanted to do was to produce some sort of similar deal for the Iranians, who were also asking for a better deal, because that was going to reduce the receipts that the exchequer received. So the British fended them off and tried to do so for as long as possible. They made a better deal called the Supplemental Agreement. And I suspect, I have no evidence to prove this, except that when I read the 1979 report on the fall of the Shah and see what was going on then, I suspect that BP, or Anglo-Iranian as it was probably paying the Shah, and that's why the Shah supported the deal. But it was not enough for his increasingly volatile parliament, the Majlis. And they opposed it, thanks to the increasing influence of Mossadegh, who of course became Prime Minister in 1951. Now, the British were hoping that they could get the Americans in on the side and manage to either get rid of Mossadegh or get him to sort of rein his demands in. But Dean Acheson was having none of that. And in fact, when Dean Acheson discovered that MI6 was trying to talk to the tribesmen of southern Iran to persuade them perhaps to declare UDI from Tehran, he stepped in and he said that this was not on. And the Americans acted as a referee, and that really destroyed any hopes that the Attlee government had of pushing Mossadegh into a corner. Of course, eventually the Americans and the British did combine to overthrow him. And the reason they did so is either communism or oil. I tend to think it's oil, and I think of a conversation that happened very early in 1953 between Eisenhower and his advisors. And up to that point, the British had strangled the Iranian economy quite effectively with an oil boycott. But there were signs that that was about to change because tanker charter rates were dropping away. And the problem was the Iranians had no tankers of their own, so they couldn't ship the oil out anyway. But the charter rates were dropping. And when Mossadegh then threatened to dump his oil on the market, had vast amounts of oil building up, when he threatened to dump that on the market in 1953, the Americans took that very seriously because of the effect it would have on Aramco. And that is the moment that changed America's attitude towards Mossadegh and persuaded them to get involved in the coup. Now, the coup, the British hoped the coup would have a salutary lesson for another man, Nasser, who, of course, was already by then in power. And it didn't, really, in short. Because, again, they couldn't persuade, they were hoping that they could persuade the Americans to come in on their side in their dispute with Nasser over the Suez base, which was now sort of a big issue. And the Americans refused to do so all the time because they saw Nasser as this bright hope. They had hoped that they could bring democracy to the Middle East in the 1940s, but that hadn't worked, and they tried in Syria, and then they'd ended up rigging elections in Syria because they realised that just if they didn't do that, somebody else will, and everyone was paying somebody in those kinds of elections. So they started to think more about strongmen. And, of course, in 1952, that led them to back the Free Officers. And the Free Officers got into power. The British were completely unaware of what happened. One of the most interesting sources I came across in the book was the diary of a man called John Slade Baker. And Slade Baker was a journalist for the Sunday Times, but he was also working for MI6 at the same time. And what comes absolutely clear from that is that, from judging from the kind of questions or information that he was being asked to find, was that, in fact, at that point, the British government were more interested in connections between the ex-German army officers who were involved in training the Egyptian army than they were in Nasser's relationship with Moscow at that point in time. The thing that they thought was that these Germans who'd come in to train the Egyptian army, the Egyptian army, might be some sort of vanguard or some sort of Nazi plot, in fact. And that was the thing that MI6 was trying to find out in the autumn of 1952. And we know that thanks to this wonderful diary, which is not, of course, in the British government archives, but is in the Middle East Centre in Oxford. I need to crack on, because my time is running out and the questions were always more fun than the speech. Suez itself started as... the Suez is like it's one tine of a three-pronged plan. And I'm going to talk a bit about that plan before I finish. Because in 1955, by 1955, the British and the Americans have both realised that perhaps Nasser wasn't such a good bet. Of course, at the end of 1955, in October, Nasser bought weapons from the Russians because he was so fed up with dealing with the Americans who had promised him arms. Dulles, the Secretary of State, had gone to Cairo and given Naguib, the then Egyptian Prime Minister, a pistol in 1953 on his visit. And this moment was captured on film, rather unfortunately. The Americans said it was never supposed to happen. But the picture of a grinning Dulles presenting an equally cheerful Naguib with this pistol was beamed around the world. And that was supposed to be a sign of what was coming. But they could never agree on how these arms would be delivered and what the Egyptians would do in exchange. And so by the end of 1955, the relationship was bad. But the British were worried about something else as well. They were worried about the Saudis, because by now Saudi oil was flowing strongly. And they were worried about the corrupting influence of the Saudis, because they could see Saudi money pouring into other parts of the Middle East, notably Jordan and Syria. And the Saudis were trying to disrupt another British plan, which was to create a sort of defensive construct called the Baghdad Pact, which was going to link Jordan and Iraq together and form a new British, a sort of post-Suez base for Britain in the region. And the Saudis could see this. They were worried about being locked into the Arabian Peninsula by the British, who they regarded as a hostile power, and were doing their utmost to bribe people to stop this from happening. So Britain's first concern was the Saudis, and they did their utmost through a mixture of information warfare and making noises to the Iraqis about the possibility of Iraq invading Saudi Arabia to push back against this. And they were hoping that they might get the Americans involved in too. The Saudis, of course, were paying, or they were, yes, they were financing both Nasser and the Syrians at that time. So they were the other two prongs of the plan. So the three-pronged plan in 1956 involved getting rid of King Saud, Ibn Saud's successor, the Kuwaitis of Syria, and also Nasser at the same time. And the Americans managed to get this back to just the Syrians. They thought that what was going to happen at the end of 1956 would be an attempt to overthrow the Syrian government, which suited them as well because Syria had become increasingly left-wing. But of course, in the background, the British were also thinking about Suez and thinking about Nasser. And once Nasser had seemed to be involved in the removal of Glub Pasha in 1956, which was not the case, but it looked the case because of just the coincidence of the timing, the British decided, or Eden decided in particular, that Nasser risked being his nemesis, and he was determined to get rid of him. He was determined to get rid of him, I think, he thought he could get rid of him, for an interesting reason. I don't think, in a way, I don't have much to add in the book to the story that we know about Suez as a whole, but there is interesting intelligence through this man, Slade Baker, which I think explains why Britain pursued this scheme. Because Slade Baker, the correspondent who was also sending other reports back to London, had very good relations both with Nasser and other members of the RCC, the free officers. And in particular, Amer, the Minister of Defence. And in one of the conversations that he has with Amer, once the Suez crisis has started, he approaches, or he says to Amer, you know, what do you think is going to happen? And Amer says to him, don't worry, you will win. And this is something that he records in his diary. And I assume that his diaries essentially were a way of recording information in the most sort of benign way possible, so that he could then write it up and send it back to London. And so I think that there were mixed messages certainly coming from Egypt, but one of the messages coming back was actually a sort of Egyptian fatalism about the outcome of this crisis if it ever came to violence. And I think that helped encourage Britain to get in the mess they did at the end of 1956. Suez had enormous ripples back, and essentially, I think that the beginning of the end of British rule in the Middle East started with the oil deal in 1950 and with the fact that Britain could not match what the Americans had done. But Suez kind of capped it, because that had effects in, most importantly, in Iraq, where the Iraqi government was well aware they had a problem, that they needed to do something to react to the propaganda that Nasser was putting out. They had begun an attempt at sort of big public works, but the projects tended to sort of splurge money at the wrong kind of things, and they weren't seeing the uplift that they expected. And so the question was, it was when the Iraqis were going to be overthrown rather than, or when the Hashemite regime was going to be overthrown rather than if. And of course that happened finally in the summer of 1958. That left the British essentially back where they had started in Saudi Arabia. They had begun there at the turn of the 19th century when Napoleon VIII invaded Egypt. The first people that the British turned to protect India was the Sultan of Muscat. And they fought a deal with him, and they found him back there, found themselves back there with him at the end of the 50s. And a great source in the book, David Smiley, the colonel who had gone off to become the Sultan of Oman's advisor. And the Sultan sort of told him about all the things that Britain had done wrong. And Smiley sort of gingerly suggested the idea of actually promoting some of the Arabs out of the ranks and make them officers. And the Sultan told him, he said, all the revolutions in the Middle East are led by colonels. Colonel Smiley, I'm having no Arab colonels in my army, which is slightly ironic given eventually that it was British colonels who did for him in 1970. But the British waged a war there. I think that the secrecy of that war, the fact that the SAS was involved, was not so much, it was partly because of the politics, of military politics of finding a job for the SAS, but it was also to hide their role from the public eye, so that the Americans were not going to be brought in and the Americans were not going to criticise what was going on. I think that was a very important aspect of why those troops in particular and not a larger force were used. The British tried to get their revenge, and I'll just finish with the story of what happened in Aden and around north of Aden in Yemen, given that it's rather topical. In 1962, after there was a Republican coup in Yemen, in Sana'a, and there was a great question between Washington and London about whether to recognise the new regime. Because after all, the old regime, the Imam, he was an incredibly reactionary man. I won't tell you some of the stories. They're not really suitable for general conversation about what he was like. But you'll find them in the book. And so the Americans were, under Kennedy, were absolutely determined that they should recognise the new Republican regime. At this point, enter a man called Billy McLean, Conservative MP for Inverness at that time. Of course, it takes us back a bit. It's very interesting. He had fought with Julian Amery in Special Operations Executive during the war, and he was a man who sort of just didn't really have enough to do. And in fact, he'd just been charged with drink driving. He'd had a rather sort of bibulous evening round St James's, and then was stopped by the police and charged. And this was before the breathalyzer, so when he came to court, it was going to be a question of his word versus the policeman's, and he got off in the end. But obviously, between this happening and the court case, someone thought it might be best if he made himself scarce. And he went to Yemen, and he performed the role that Lawrence of Arabia had performed 50 years before, because Lawrence was sent in to sort of provide a kind of on-the-spot view of what was going on that was going to outweigh any kind of theoretical idea about whether Britain should send troops to support the Arab revolt in 1916. And McLean goes, and again, British information and intelligence about what was going on in Yemen at that time was incredibly sketchy. And he goes in, and his report is in the National Archives. It's the most extraordinary thing, complete with lots of pictures of dead Egyptian soldiers that he had seen and photographed. But he goes there and explains how the rebellion being mounted by the royalist forces, the people who supported the Imam, was going much better than he thought. And best of all, he met an Egyptian soldier who had been captured by the royalists and the tribesmen. And this man told him that before they'd gone out, they had a parade at which Nasser addressed them and told them that their job was to boot the British out of Aden. And McLean came back and he saw Amery, by then Secretary for Air, I think, and of course Macmillan, Amery's father-in-law, and put to them the idea of not recognising the government. And after that, the British pumped in weapons to try and tie Nasser down, which indeed they succeeded in doing. It was a rather pyrrhic victory, though, because, of course, the end aim of it was to try and keep the British in Aden, but of course they failed to do that. I'll just finish with the irony, because I've already gone on far too long. The Americans had spent the entire period of this story trying to get the British out of the Middle East. If you think of back to Wilkie had a conversation with the British ambassador at the end of 1942, and he said, the British ambassador quoted him saying, "The sooner that we were gone, the better." But come 1964-65, Labour in power and facing rather strained economics and financial circumstances, and are wondering what to do. And by that point, the Americans are desperate to keep them there, because Aden served as the base from which it was possible to protect places like Kuwait and the Gulf states as well. And so it was actually a very, very important piece of imperial real estate. But by that time, the British government had really decided that they were going to sacrifice empire for welfare. And they decided that given they hadn't got the money, they were going to have to retreat. And so that is what they did. And I'll finish just with the words of Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State at that time. I think it was George Brown who came to see him, the British Foreign Secretary at that time, to explain the decision that the British government had come to. And Rusk told him, "For God's sake, act like Britain." And I'll stop there.